Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 99, where Tom, Sam, Pedro, and our special guest Summer are discussing a 1990 article by Joan Ocker titled Hierarchies, Jobs, Bodies, A Gendered Theory of Organizations, published in the journal Gender and Society. In part two, we will discuss to what extent organizations continue to be gendered, as Ocker argued, and what it means for organizations to become more humane and democratic. If you missed part one, please visit our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation.
When I think of new directions from Ocker's work, you know, she asks these hugely important questions right before the conclusion. Is the abstract worker white as well as male? Are white male-dominated organizations built on underlying assumptions about the proper place of people with different skin colors? Are racial differences produced by organizational practices as gender differences are? And we've seen researchers take this up. Like Victor Ray has a very important piece of work that talks about how organizations are racialized as well as being gendered, right? So what I see as like an important continuation is throughout her paper, there are ways in which you could include a different social category and use the sort of analytical tools and research tools that she's imploring us to use to examine how race is enacted in workplaces, how Black male bodies are sexualized and objectified in work organizations in ways that perhaps white male bodies are not. We even see that in Pat Turco has a paper on this, right, where she uses a lot of Ocker's concepts here about how the threat of pregnancy is a detriment to women, but the objectification and sexualization of Black male bodies is a detriment to Black men in the organization too. So there's a lot in here that pushes us to think about how social categories are enacted in the workplace that build off of Ocker's work. And that's what I find most exciting about this piece.
And similarly, besides the explicit, I think, direction she gives, I think there is like truffles, many gems hidden across the text, right? That we can now, I think, almost 30 years later, look and see the research has been done and also some opportunities, right? So for example, when she was talking about the way in which particular hobbies are gendered, meaning that participation in them is understood as positive for the workplace experience. You know, I think she talks about sports and team playing and how these are coded in ways that are understood as, if anything, being aligned and a door into the experience at the work versus, I don't know, what would be coded as typically feminine such time as knitting or something like that, right? Which would not necessarily be something that would be understood as a skill. I'm thinking also about the work of Lauren Rivera, which is more about class, right? And how your experience in college of particular hobbies also is actually fundamental to getting access to prestigious jobs in, I think she studied high-scale consultancies, right? We can think also in terms of race. So all of the ways in which access to cultural capital, right, and taste and life experiences is also some form of more hidden or indirect ways in which it's not just the person you are, the skin color that you have, or your zip code, but also the opportunities that you had and what was your life world around you and how that can be coded as positive or negative or as connected or disconnected to what it would be the ideal experience to bring to the workplace.
Yeah, that's a great point. And when you mentioned sports, that is a double-edged sword. And I imagine that we could probably find similar challenges with other factors or other things that people use to build cultural capital. Because on the one hand, sports is something that should lend itself to more democracy. I mean, it should lend itself to more equality, because especially nowadays, we think about 1990, I think women's professional basketball leagues were just finally making it into reality, for example. Women tennis players had been there he had the Battle of the Sexes in the 70s, which I still remember. I'm dating myself now. But when it comes to sports, on the good side, you know, with the democracy, you do see more equal participation in terms of who gets to participate. What you don't see then is how the changes in the conversations about what sports we talk about and how sports enters the language of the workplace. So I think, for example, American football, which is probably the one sport in the United States which is the most not played by women, but it's the one sport that probably gets the largest amount of conversation. As we're recording this, we're only a few days away from the Super Bowl, which is the American Football Championship, in which you guaranteed are probably in many workplaces around the country, everybody's talking about. But in a way that those conversations sort of reinforce some of the old standing gender norms. And so then when it comes to things like soccer, in which the U.S. women's, let's face it, Americans, the women's soccer team is better than the men's soccer team, relatively speaking. The conversation is very different. We don't hear that being discussed nearly as much.
Well, I was just trying to think about how to build off of that. I think it's right, because I kind of heard like two things. You know, what Pedro was initially talking about, which is, you know, how we talk about sports as like a language of inclusion and also like the cultural repertoires that participating in them give you. And then what I like about Tom's point too is the ways in which what should be this great democratizing sort of experience, we have very clear examples of it being differentially valued, right? Which Acker and others would tell us would be the case, right? Even if the women's soccer team is demonstrably like better performing, they're still paid less and they're still valued less within like the social zeitgeist than the U.S. men's soccer team. It's interesting. I don't know.
So this leads me to perhaps a tangential point, which is exactly about this idea of democracy, right? Because she also ends the paper suggesting that, and again, she also talks about that earlier, that a true feminist theorizing and practice would entail bringing to fruition a more humane, democratic way of organizing. And, you know, that seems to be one of the tacit goals of the piece, right? And of course, of the feminism at large. But we also know that, unfortunately, not all experiments in trying to realize feminist organizations, and she mentions that as well, right, have been able to realize such aspirations.
Yes, and I guess it starts with what do we mean by, or what does she mean by humane and democratic? I'll give you my interpretation, and let's just kind of open it up for other ideas. To me, it's a matter of that all members of the organization have equitable opportunity to participate in the accomplishment of the job, regardless of one's demography. Their contributions are valued based on the skills, knowledge, and attitudes that they present to the organization, which would erase is not the right word, but which would mute the qualities of gender, because we would think of the man and the woman, and that the organization accommodates those differences, and that people are not valued. I guess what I'm getting at is it's more the intrinsic value of the individual as opposed to the extrinsic value, because the extrinsic value is all of these things that get in the way of that.
So what that makes me think is that it's interesting that such effort, besides the one that she cites in terms of the feminist organizing and so on, you know, it's interesting that talking about flat or less hierarchical organizations, right, or new forms that are more democratic, I mean, it has always existed, this debate, and it's still one that exists, right, and it's very interesting. People have been talking about models like holacracy and many, many others. They don't have necessarily this explicit goal of bringing equality, but there is something about this democratic undertone, right? And the recognition in the case of holacracy that we should do away of hierarchy and try to think of people in terms of their roles and their contribution and how different people have different skills, and therefore we can design roles around that and match people to particular roles and see this more of an organic way. That dimension that I think has gone further There have been, of course, experiments with creating feminist organizations, including some that selectively draw on some structures, bureaucratic structures included, and there are interesting research written about that. One of them is the work of Carolee Ashcraft that talks about feminist bureaucracies. So there have been ways in which trying to organize towards particular values and goals. But the challenge is that, of course, they have run into all sorts of obstacles and problems and new challenges. So the goal is valuable, but I think the realizing it is still the challenge.
Yeah, I think there's, I mean, that's nice because I was thinking about what Tom said and now what you said. And I think there's two points of discussion which are kind of left open. And I know it's unfair to set the expectations on that this article would provide both the critique but also resolve and give us all the answers. Even though I kind of did expect that, to be honest. I remember the first time I read this. And because she starts with saying, basically, you know, we know about all this stuff, but we haven't gone one step further into providing a feminist theory of organizations. But then, you know, when she explains what a gender organization looks like, it still, for my taste, it still kind of stays in this idea of let's think about roles and jobs and hierarchies and all of that as gendered. But then she doesn't give us a very clear idea of what a feminist, you know, what the ideal is, what we should be aspiring to. And so there's a discussion of for what, which is this idea of, okay, we would have a more humane, democratic society if we change the way or if we change the way how we think about organizations, how we study them, how we run them, how we manage them, etc. But yeah, I don't know. I don't think she gives a lot of ideas as to how that would be. And like you said, there have been some works but that try to build on that and that try to provide some sort of structure or image of how these might look like. But I don't know. It's not so clear to me.
Well, I guess one of the questions I would ask is, what is the biggest barriers, you know, things that get in the way that aren't necessarily gendered, but just simply exist that make changing organizations difficult in the first place? Because I know that there's an appeal to thinking about flattening the organization would produce more democracy, for example. I have heard that theme before, but that's not really true, is it? I mean, they're separate variables. What I kind of come down to is thinking about competitive pressures. One of the things that makes the current form of organizing successful is how it responds to competitive pressures. And what I'm wondering is, thinking about some of the examples that we've been going through, how it is that competition is a source of causing organizations to either abandon new ideas or revert or whatever. And I'm going to use the example of the robot scene in American Factory, where, you know, at the end of part one, we were talking about how important it is for organizations to be more humane and to assume the state of members, their lives, their situations, whatever, and incorporate that into the organization in such a way that the people can be taken care of, that there's and continue to contribute to the organization. But in the face of competitive pressure, what's been happening instead is we're finding ways to automate things and take it out of human hands entirely, whether it's robots doing industrial work or it's apps or databases or robocalls or other sort of technological solutions, chat agents on your computer, for example, that sort of take the human out of the loop, and thereby the organization doesn't have to contend with all of the messiness of what are the needs of each of the individuals. It's a separate problem, but I don't see how you can perhaps solve one problem of trying to make organizations more humane until you have an environment that welcomes it. And that's something that's really big. That's a significant problem because it's global. I mean, it's a global competition that we're talking about. Does that make sense?
So if since everything is intersected, right, and organizations are part of an ecology, also means that capitalism plays a role. I think that's what I take from your point. And I was going to add as well that, and Acker mentions that as well, we are all socialized in gender inequality, right? So I think that's also why some of the experiments by feminists have failed, because it's not just men and women, but also women and women, men and men, and how these gendered ideas and signs and symbols that we have and the way we think about power, you know, get reproduced. So I think that some of that is one of the stories why some of the experiments of some feminist collectives may have not delivered on the promises, because we are all products of these particular ideas. So I think there's that as well. But I also think that some of these discussions, and that's why I was mentioning the work of Ashcraft, which I think is particularly interesting, because it's trying to think of ways in which we can leverage ways of organizing that we are familiar with, like bureaucracy, but instill into them through practices and meanings that lead to more democratic, lateral, collaborative attitudes in the way we approach hierarchy, deference, obedience, you know, participation, and so on and so forth, right? Because I feel that sometimes the conversation becomes a little bit dualistic or dichotomic in terms of, you know, as I said, Tom, just take away structure when we're all good, but actually it is a structure that both in bureaucracy but in beyond, right, has brought us some positive things. So reading the paper, I could not think that, yes, the way in which jobs have been designed have all of this, but also, and again, I mentioned I was reading the paper just last night, the idea that there is such a thing as an office, that you could occupy an office regardless what is your affiliation to the person in power, regardless of what particular tribe you are part of, your rank in society, that is supposed to be, people should be selected on the basis of their competence and skills. And of course, we know that the way selections take place have all of this bias, but this was revolutionary at some point. Imagine the idea that one could occupy something that should be independent, and the work should be independent of exactly who you are, your participation, your ties, your kinship, and so on. So that is, has that promise. And of course, like everything, we do one step ahead and two steps back, or the other way around, right? So there's a perpetual effort, I think, in trying to figure out new ways to deal with this problem that it has been with us for such a long time.
Yeah, I think that's why I like one of the questions that she pushes us to ask is, you know, what are the norms and systems of meaning that govern a space? And so while you can have an ideal bureaucratic structure, people are going into those spaces, you know, as you said, Pedro, socialized into gender inequality or socialized into racial inequality or class-based inequality or whatever it is. And so when we see these experiments not going as well as the implementers had hoped, it's because like the norms and the systems of meaning, you really have to like push hard and interrogate, you know, what's going on here. You know, what is it that people are truly valuing, and how is our structure enforcing and reinforcing and constituting that message, you know? So it's not just a reorganization of the roles, because we know that people don't always just defer to hierarchy based on roles, but also status. And so I really like this idea of thinking through like, what are the norms and systems of meaning that govern a space in order to try to get at what this more sort of humane and democratic system of organizing would be, so that we don't defer back to what we actually do in our daily lives outside of the workplace, outside of the organization.
I don't know if Acker takes it this far, but it's my interpretation and my reading of what she's proposing and offering. And it's kind of turning it around of what Pedro was saying, right? Yes, you are going to have efforts to organize differently that are probably going to fail because of all the social forces and, you know, everything that kind of goes into the organization. But you can also think of not just the organization, but more particularly like the elements that Acker puts attention to, this idea of like the symbols and the images and the interactions and the practices and all these things that make up organizations, and think that as an opportunity for social change, right? So I think my kind of interpretation when she talks about, you know, if we create more feminist organizations, we could have a more kind of humane equal society, it's like this, right? Like there's not one best way, but it has to, there has to be a lot of attention and sensitivity to identifying all the social pressures and then identifying what it is that you can begin changing in organizations in these terms of like the stuff that structures and guides the very daily interactions and how maybe that way you can be successful.
I think one of the challenges that I'm having thinking about this is how we're using the term failure. It was sort of the critique of how she was referring to the previous work by earlier feminist scholars. But it also kind of strikes me that in this particular case, when we're talking about an experiment, the word failure almost takes on symbolic meaning of its own, having absolutely nothing to do with whether or not anything was accomplished by the experiment. Because I'm sure that the experiment actually accomplished a lot, but because it didn't deliver on what was probably impossible to deliver, then it gets attributed as failure, right? Especially nowadays with our wonderfully, you know, objective information environment, everything is everything, even if it succeeds, it's branded a failure because it's in somebody's interest to brand it a failure. I want to go back to the story of Don't Ask, Don't Tell in the U.S. military. I think it has a lesson for how this would be achieved at a pace that would not satisfy anybody, but is probably realistic in a way. So Don't Ask, Don't Tell, for those who are not familiar with it, was the policy that was established, I want to say 1993 or 1994. This was basically President Bill Clinton's promise that the U.S. military would be open for homosexuals, that it would be a way of allowing them to serve, because before then, they were forbidden from serving. Over the course of some 16 years, largely, I would say, driven by the fact that LGBT personnel were serving honorably in military operations, and was basically the whole idea of excluding homosexuals just sort of withered away in the mind of many soldiers, simply because they were serving next to those, you know, personnel. And it was like not a deal. It wasn't a thing. So while the revocation of that law was kind of treated by some as a really, really big deal, it went without a whimper. It was just the law's gone and we have them integrated and we're dealing. And what that kind of tells me is that, in any case of this type where we're trying to experiment on something that's going to be a very significant intervention, especially of a deeply embedded social norm, it's going to take a lot of time. And the first experiments, whatever you want to call it, are going to be doomed in one manner of speaking. But the key, I think, is the continued learning and the continued persistence on the ideal being pursued that will eventually get people to come around and through example, through exposure. I think this is a contact theory kind of a thing, that the values that were held previously don't carry the weight that they used to, or that there's reason to question them. Otherwise, it'll be too easy for some new initiative like that to be rejected.
That's a very nice take and reminds me of an interview I read with Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, and she's talking exactly about social change, right? And sometimes we tend to be impatient, but we should celebrate, I think, the steps. It also reminded me on the debate that we had about organic and mechanistic structures when we read the work of Burns and Stalker, and we realized something that sometimes is forgotten from the book, is that a lot of the description and theorizing and details on the book is about the challenges of moving from one system to another, on how there is all the pushback, on how it's important to understand that you're going from one, I don't know, set of equilibrium to another, and how understanding these potential minefields is important, right? And how that the typology actually should serve to understand change and efforts in trying to, in that case, in bringing more collaborative, lateral type of process in organization, which is not so far from what we're discussing today, and how it's important to understand that there is kind of a process, right? And how there are some usual risk or challenge that come with that, and how cultivating, and to go back to what Summer was saying, some images, we may say, of symbols of understanding is as important as implementing a particular, you know, new procedure and so on, right? So I think there's something about this ability to imagine and share such imagination and understand that the practice is going to lag behind what is the idea, what is the value, what is the goal, right? And continuously trying to celebrate and correct this process. That's what I take from that.
Yeah, you mentioned the future of work, Pedro, but I didn't catch how you wanted to connect to that.
So I think it's particularly interesting to read this text and the whole ideas that it poses for how should we value different forms of work in light of the discussions that Tom was bringing about automation and AI and technological change, right? The quote-unquote future of work. And one of the things that this debate sometimes poses is that as maybe tasks will become more automatized, right? And then they will get out of the purview of particular professions and occupations. Then we will find new work to be done or rearrange the way we spend our time. And I think it is interesting that if you follow such assumption, of course, there's many big assumptions into this debate, then things like care work will probably become more valuable. So if that is true, that a lot of think about industrial tasks will be automatized, then all of the care for senior people, for children, for the education, all this kind of stuff will become even, I would say, even more prominent because there will be the ones in which we should invest more of our energy and our time. And of course, there's all sorts of utopia embedded into this debate. But I think that's an interesting question to think. What are the changes that we are witnessing? What do they mean in terms of what kind of work is going to be valued or not valued, and you know, to what extent such ideas that we seem to nurture as these new technologies get a root into the workplace, what they may mean to such aspirations as the one discussed by Acker in terms of democratic, more humane type of organizations and societies.
The first question that comes to my mind is, are we still with these new technologies and new workplaces like social media and whatever, are we reinforcing genderism? The first thought that came to my mind is, what's a social media influencer?
Yeah, I think there's a related question to that, to what you're posing, Pedro, which is also how these technologies, but not just these new technologies, but also just like the general discussions about boundaries are going to lead to, right? Like what I see a lot of discussions on the one hand, this idea of becoming more and more immersed in the organization. And so the organization has to kind of change and adapt to also serve as a kind of private space. So the flexibilization of work and working from home and being able to, for example, bring your children, or, you know, you're raising that traditional boundary between family life or personal life and work life. But also that there seems to be a discussion that's reacting to that, which is establishing more kind of formal, clear limits to work and working less hours, and you know, this idea of really completely separating these spheres. And so I think that that's another discussion that may or may not interact with the idea of technology and the future of work, but I think it's also about the future of work.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting thought experiment, Pedro, that you're asking, and I'm sure there are people that are working on this, but it just made me think, you know, in Acker's paper, she talks about how emotional work and emotional tasks, drawing on Arlie Hochschild's work, are often done by women, and this emotional work is devalued in our system. And then to Tom's earlier point, now you have chatbots that are interacting as customer service agents. And we know like a key component of customer service agents is like managing the emotional content of the client, right? And so they're trying to create chatbots that can mimic the emotional work that humans were doing. So it's a very interesting like thought experiment as these things get entangled with each other. You have emotional work, which is traditionally devalued, and you have chatbots and AI, which is this like sexy, high status sort of thing. And now you have them doing the two. I don't know. I'm sure people are looking at this like, now is that sort of work now interesting, right? As the tasks are taken over by robots and AI and working on these things, is that the interesting thing, the valued thing to work on in a way that it wasn't when it was women and others doing the emotional labor? But it's a interesting thought experiment. I wonder what Acker would say.
I have an additional problem or thing to consider in this discussion of the future of work and gendered organizations. It made me think, like right before this podcast, I was teaching a class on public policy, and there's a PhD student that's working on identifying like all these, all the effects that global warming and all these disasters is going to have on the complexity and the difficulty of care work at the home, especially for people of lower income, and how that it's obviously going to affect them disproportionately, like not having access to water and, you know, all these other kinds of problems that are going to impact these homes, and how that is also going to change women's ability to work and to participate in the formal labor force. And so that, I think, is also a, you know, not so sexy image of the future of work, but that's also going to be about the future of work, and that's going to impact the majority of population, right? Not just women that are working in these companies that are going to adopt these new technologies, but just women in their regular jobs and how it's going to affect them disproportionately, right? So these,
I mean, I started with the utopia, right? So as I hear of that, what actually came to mind? And just a quick plug for our listeners, we discussed the work of Arlie Hochschild on episode 35, so you're curious, you can check that as well. But what made me think is that invisibility, as has been discussed by many feminist scholars and beyond, is an important dimension of these types of work, right, that we have been referring to. And as we always know, women have always worked, the extent to which how that work was valued, and not just valued, but made visible. And I was thinking that to some extent, technological change can actually contribute to hide further some work, because clerical work can be further hidden because it can be now be geographically and also time-wise distanced. So there is also that. Sam's point on thinking in terms of more social arrangements made me think that as climate change goes further and more disruption happens and people move across more and more, we know that, to go back to the intersection thing, work and care work has not only been gendered, but also racialized in terms of particular people in some places have done such work that usually are tied into mobility networks and all sorts of global chains. Right, so it's also this dimension that I think that these rearrangements we are experiencing, either because climate change, technological change, social disruption, to talk about the social media that Tom was talking about, I think they reconfigure the extent in which some forms of work are not just valued or not valued, but also made visible to us and seen as connected, as relevant, as in the purview of particular tasks or orders of organizations and so on. In a way, the problem has exploded with it existing so many other levels and dimensions.
I think Acker had also mentioned the problem of unpaid work, which is aligned with what you're also mentioning, because there's also a lot of arrangements that have hinged on not just the manager or the executive being male, but that the spouse or the wife in particular had a particular role in, I guess, supporting the husband, as in a visible, like a first lady or even a preacher's wife, where there's that aspect of unpaid labor, expectations upon the spouse of a leader that is, it's a pattern that is continuing to reassert itself in a very gendered fashion, because in the case of the female manager, the husband is not typically expected to play the same role. And there's also been misbehavior by the spouse, or for example, like if a family member of the manager, like the manager is expected to have total control, not just of what they're doing in the workplace, but also kind of wraps over their family. And when family members or the spouse misbehaves or doesn't follow this norm, then it puts the manager in hot water. But you know what I mean, right?
I think I can see that most clearly in sort of in politics and like the expectations we have around male politicians versus female politicians and who's accountable for whose actions.
But I think we go to where we started, right? The organizations always had this externality that was hidden, that in order for people to work, they have dependent of all of this ecology of work around the person, right? And of course, usually tradition was the man going to work and the woman providing all of this sort of care work, but not just that, all sorts of other things that allowed that to happen. And to what extent this is kind of tacit, there's a tacit form in which in reality is there is a relationship, there is interdependencies that are not considered as we, the way we build the models we have for organizations.
Yeah, and I guess the question I have is, you know, granted that, you know, these externalities are hidden, are they necessarily bad? There's a reason for it. We may not like it, but there is some sort of justification for its existence. And I think that sometimes those externalities, if we aren't careful in how we address them as we try to make organizations more humane and democratic, it will make it that much easier for the new ideas to be rejected, right?
Also, I was thinking about building off what Pedro and Tom were saying about how AI and technology can make certain things more or less visible. And is this always a good or a bad thing? It reminds me of work by Courtney McClooney, who found that during the pandemic, a lot of Black workers really enjoyed working remotely, right? Because it helped dampen the effect of their race in the workplace. And so that invisibility sort of contributed to their emotional and psychological well-being. And they felt like they could be more effective and productive members because they weren't having to deal with the ways in which their physical form was being hyper-visible in a workplace.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And I wonder, you know, what's going to be the impact of reverting? Because, you know, now we're recording this in early 2023. The pandemic is sort of going back and you see organizations trying to reassert the status quo ante in some cases? Are we going to lose what we've learned?
And that is a debate even in our own field in terms of inclusivity and to what extent we should keep things online or not and how it's allowed to participate, but to what extent that only having it online is a subpar experience. So this is also a complicated knot to unravel. And I totally said this point that invisibility can also have this impact on especially of hyper-visible, right? So you can finally maybe be taken by the outputs of your labor, not just by who you are producing that labor. But then I wonder, would that have an impact in terms of career progression? We don't have this experiment because the pandemic was time limited, but I wonder if this thing went around for 10 years. That's one of the things that people debate as well. So we have this participation that works in certain ways, but also what impact it has because you're not socializing the same way, not participating in some aspects of the work. That's tricky.
I mean, we've gone back to our discussion of, you know, the chicken and egg. Like, are these kinds of experiments, do they have chances of being successful given that society works in a certain way? Or can we think of organizations as a mechanism of social change? So I think in this idea of, you know, after the pandemic and there's this battle of should we think about new ways of thinking and organizing work or should we go back to the way things were? I don't know, right? Because I think, at least from personal experience and women that I know that have had to go back to the workplace and can no longer do working from home and you know they are the primary kind of caregivers in their home. This is of course bad because during the pandemic they at least could kind of be in the two places at once, which is, you know, from a kind of more macro point of view, is not really ideal because then you're doubling the workload. So is it better that they do have to go back to work so the state feels the pressure to maybe improve the services that it provides to working mothers, right, in terms of daycare and all those kinds of programs, which at least in Mexico have been, they were the first ones to go with this new administration. So it's, yeah, I don't know. I don't think there's an easy answer to what will be better in terms of gender inequality.
I suspect it's going to have a lot to do with the organization and the type of work. I remember visiting a news organization not too long ago that it after the pandemic, they came up with the rule that said you only have to be in the office one day a week. We kind of like this remote stuff. It actually works better for us and it works better for everybody. So different organizations, I guess, are going to have their different responses. And maybe this is where competition is good. Let the competition decide, you know, decide which way is better for whom, and not, you know, we don't want to tailor our way out of this one.
I think that the fact that we have been able to grapple and think through so many of current issues just speaks to the timelinessness of this paper and its relevance. But we talked a lot about in terms of the debates that the paper puts forward in terms of democratic human workplaces and gender inequality. But I also think that has longer impact or bigger impact in terms of social theory and organizational research in terms of how we think about work at large. Because there's so many parallels to many of the ideas that have emerged after on thinking in more relational terms. In terms of nowadays expertise of occupations or whatever, which is exactly what the paper does in an indirect way, valuing and making visible these interdependencies, the more relational manner of thinking about social action. Also, I thought in terms of the way it showcases the effort involved in such work, and I was thinking about the work that has emerged after, about routines of some of the stuff that we take for granted that is just, you know, happening on the back, but actually take a lot of effortful accomplishments, right? So it seems to be also a link there. And I think finally, this idea that we were talking that in terms of how structure and symbols, formalities of work life and the ways we understand them and continues to understand it and reproduce such understanding is one of the mechanisms through which inequality, but also change and flexibility and different ways of operating enter organizations, right? So I think besides the particular topic of gender inequalities, I think that all of these analytical moves that Acker makes also expands our way of thinking about work and how it is organized.
100% agree. And thanks for laying that out, Pedro. I thought, like, from the first get-go, she lays down an incredibly important gauntlet, you know, in telling us that and calls us to task to really start to think about how these organizations are gendered and how these taken for granted assumptions are operating, and that we, you know, and that it's our job as researchers to reveal these and to challenge them. So I thought from the get-go, she comes right out of the gates with by like just laying down the gauntlet. And then when I think about how her work has been expanded and extended over time to look at other types of social categories like Victor Ray's work on racialized organizations or Adia Harvey Wingfield's work on race and class and men and race and class, you know, and these different intersections. She really lays out like an important toolkit and recipe for thinking about, like, as an organizational scholar and maybe even as an organizational ethnographer, right? How can we go about doing this type of research? And what are the types of questions we should be asking, the types of things we should be looking at so that we can actually have, you know, informed, holistic view of the organization and how, yeah, as you said, how our work is organized. And so I find it to be, one, seminal and important for the time period in which it was written, and two, just so helpful to future researchers in terms of and, you know, structuring our thinking and pushing us to really interrogate these systems of meaning.
Yes, I agree with Pedro and Sommer's kind of summary and reading about the importance of this text. I think it allows us to think about organizations differently and therefore to study them and design them and manage them differently. And I think it's very nice how it connects and how it's relevant, both if you want to look at the interactional micro level, but also to think about the greater social implications of both these interactions and also the organizational structures. And I guess the challenge that I take from rereading this text and from our conversation is to think more about what it can bring to organizations that are facing more kind of particular or extreme challenges. We mentioned before, and we talked about before, this interaction with race, with inequality, with how changes in the way we work and think about organizations affect women in a different way, but not just women, but also women from, you know, marginalized social groups. So I think that for me is a challenge, just how it speaks, because, you know, it's kind of set up in a very, thinking about these gender organizations in a way, in a very abstract way, right? Like what each of us think it's a typical organization. But I think the interesting challenge is to understand how that interacts with other kinds of variables as well. So, yeah.
And I'll just conclude that throwing the gauntlet down works in research. It also works in practice. I mean, ultimately, this is an area where we really do need a vision of what a humane and a democratic organization is. We're going to recognize that understanding what those terms mean probably differs greatly among different people. But the ideal is, there is a shared understanding of what the ideal is. And it certainly isn't the present day. So this is an area where research can help inform practice. And I think that it's a continuous struggle. It's something that we should understand and appreciate where we came from. I mean, there's a reason why we chose this particular one, because it was in the bow wave of a whole line of thinking. And I know after the Me Too movement and some of the other events that have happened in relation to the pandemic, has brought, I think, renewed urgency of trying to find ways to democratize and make organizations more humane. And we should keep it going. It's a conversation that needs to continue. There will never be a final, firm, total answer. It's a struggle, and it's an ideal that that we are seeking.
We thank Summer Jackson for graciously joining us in this episode.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.